A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Specter. This week, our comrade Dante from the Bay Area sits down in an interview-style episode with our very special guest, Victor Grossman. Born in 1928 in New York City, Harvard graduate and social justice activist Victor Grossman was a U.S. soldier stationed in Germany in 1952. Victor holds an incredible story of why, in that year, he defected to the Soviet zone of occupied Austria from where he was sent to the German Democratic Republic of East Germany. Today, Victor lives in Berlin, Germany, and is currently on tour in America, showcasing his new book, A Socialist Defector, From Harvard to Karl Marx Alley. We are grateful that Victor made the time to sit down with our comrade Dante, and we hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome, Comrade Grossman. So let's get started. So the first question here, what year did you join the Communist Party USA and why?
I joined in the summer of 1945. I had always been a leftist. I was in the Young Communist League and the follow-up organization, American Youth for Democracy. And in my first semester at Harvard, I met another fellow who was also an AYD, but who also surprised me one day with an application to join the party. And he said, "You're a Red, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, sign this." And I was, a lot of doubts in my mind circled my down, but he didn't give me time to think much about them. He said, "Are you or aren't you?" So I signed it and became a member. 50 cents and I was in. No witnesses or anything, just easy. And that's what brought me into the party.
Okay, so this is kind of off track here, but what was the determining factor in your defection to the German Democratic Republic?
I didn't choose it. I didn't want it. I had hoped that when I got drafted in 1951 and during the Korean War, that I could serve 2 years with no trouble and get out. But you had to sign a statement you had never been a member of any left-wing organization. And I panicky at the idea of letting them know that I was, but panicky in general, I signed it, although I had been in many, and hoping that nothing would happen. But they did check up when I was in West Germany as a soldier. They checked up and told me to go to the military judge. There was up to $10,000 fine and 5 years in prison for having lied on this. And although I now know that it probably would not have come to that, I didn't know that then. I panicked completely and defected. I didn't know how to leave the army, but I chose a crazy route. Austria was divided in four sectors then, and I, to go from the United States zone to the Soviet zone, the only way I found was to swim across the Danube River, which is a dividing line, which I did, sought for hours in vain to find all the military at this Iron Curtain, couldn't find them, and was finally picked up by the police and had them bring me to the Soviets, who brought me to the German Democratic Republic across Czechoslovakia.
Right. So were the Soviets like scary people, authoritarian?
No, when I was first there, I was locked up in a cell, well, not a very nice cell, with a guard in front of the door, but bars, I could talk with him. And so with my 10 words of Russian, I tried to communicate. I tried to remember first book titles. So I said to him, Anna Karenina? And at first he didn't understand because I pronounced it wrong. Mm-hmm. But when he finally understood, he said, "Oh, he said, "Oh, I know that, it's good, I read it." And then we went to the next book, and I got a few books across and a few films, because I had seen Soviet films. One was The New Gulliver. I said, "No, Gulliver. Ah, Gulliver, I saw it, it's good." And so we communicated about literature and art. From there, they took me, they gave me a complete new outfit, because my outfit was a wreck after swimming. He said, "For you, a red tie." And then they took me to the GDR, and then they released me there in a town where many deserters were living. Were not held, but were living.
All right, so you lived in the GDR for quite some time, and you still live in Germany. So
I lived there 38 years.
So what are the great successes of socialism that you saw there and experienced in the GDR?
I saw how GDR, starting with every card stacked against it, from smaller, much poorer, lacking in natural resources, paying most reparations, discriminated against in every way, nevertheless was able year by year to build up actually a very good economy, although it was in debt at the end. It was always trying to catch up to this extremely wealthy West German economy. It could never catch up with it because it had none of the Marshall Fund millions and none of the investment funds from the big war crime companies and corporations. In fact, it didn't have them at all. It threw them all out. It threw all of these war crime, Krupp, Bayer, etc., threw them out. But this left it disadvantaged in many ways, yet it built up an economy which included free medical and dental care. Well, you paid a small tax, but then it covered all medical, all dental care with no charges for anything. Prescription drugs were covered. Sanatorium for illnesses was covered. Education was free up into postgraduate level. Child care was free. And rent and basic staples and food and fare, both city fare and long distance fare, were kept the same rate as in 1945. They never went up. And rent was about 1/10 of your income, which meant that people had almost no major economic problems. There were plenty of problems, especially in shortages of this, that, and the other thing, which they could not afford to get, and which the GDR, which had to concentrate on basic industry to get a base, and on fuel and agricultural machinery, could never catch up with consumer goods, although it tried. And some had some successes, but always shortages and problems, and all the time facing West Germany, which blasted in its television broadcast into us in the same German language, the magnificent commodities that they had to offer, which made people envious. At the same time, nobody was afraid of losing their apartment. Evicting people was forbidden by law. You couldn't be evicted. You couldn't be fired. So that the major worries that people might have about losing a job, losing their home, not paying for medical expenses up to cancer, not paying for dentals, all of that was covered. So there were no problems of that.
So there was no billionaires, right?
There were no billionaires. There were no millionaires. Well, a couple may have had close to one, but the gap between wealthy and poor was one stratum of people, especially women who had never learned a trade and had lost their husbands or during the war, had only menial jobs and cleaning up jobs. Their pensions were not good, but even they had free medical care without a tax, couldn't be evicted, had a warm meal every day almost for nothing, so that they too were never hit hard, though they had to pinch pennies. But it meant that most people had almost too much money in their pocket, which made it very difficult for the retail trade, to meet the demands that people had. This was a constant problem of having too much money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how much did U.S. imperialism affect the Soviet bloc, or GDR in your case, from your perspective?
It was not only it was not only the Americans with CIA, but especially working together with the West Germans. And together, they had a constant pressure campaign from the very first day to try to disrupt the GDR. One, even before the GDR was founded, was this airlift. They surprised the East with a new currency, which, since the wall was not yet built, would have flooded East Germany and completely wrecked the economy. That was what caused the airlift. Then they had a terrific campaign all the time, a brain drain, to lure people away, to say, finish your education in the GDR at GDR expense, whether it was as a machinist or a doctor or an engineer, but when you're finished, come on over to us and you get a good paid job. And this became dangerous to the existence of the GDR, which is basically why that wall was built. After the war, the economy moved upwards, but of course it cut people off and made a lot of people bitter, but it was good for the economy.
So could you comment on, specific leaders in the Soviet Union, like the Stalin era and the Khrushchev era, and how that affected your time in the GDR and, I guess, democracy or how things functioned?
The Stalin period, I hardly experienced. I got there in August 52 and Stalin died in March 53. However, in this period, things were very tight politically and also economically, because they were directed especially at building up a base and very hard measures, which ended partly because of an uprising, an angry uprising in June 1953. They are, however, shortly after Stalin's death. When Khrushchev became the head of the party, everything eased up. First of all, the Soviet Union stopped asking for reparations and helped. Second of all, there was so-called thaw period, when in terms of books, film, the wonderful new films, much better than any in the past. They were really humane films, which became popular in the West as well, and books which were open and discussed questions, and this helped the GDR too. This lasted basically until Khrushchev was thrown out in 64, when Brezhnev, not right away, but soon became head, and he had a heavier hand, and certain economic problems developed between the two, and also cultural problems. Things were not quite so free and easy. And then it moved on, then there were a series of leaders who didn't last long, they were very old. And then came Gorbachev, who at first was greeted very enthusiastically by almost everyone because of his peace policy, which was very good, but then was at odds with the GDR political leadership for a whole series of reasons, in the economic and also his glasnost, which opened the media completely, which had been very tightly controlled. He opened it up, which was very nice for people in some ways, but opened the way for very much pro-Western propaganda, which the GDR, which was right on the dividing line, did not want. And not only that, but Gorbachev or his people bargained with West Germany about possible unification, which naturally angered the people in the GDR who did not want to destroy the GDR and who negotiated with West Germany without the Soviets. So it came basically to a division which ended in the demise of the GDR for a whole series of reasons.
Could you comment on possible mistakes that you think happened in the GDR? And it could be closely tied to the Soviet Union collapsing as well.
Well, yes and no. Some of the blunders were based on the fact that the economic situation was always difficult and complicated because the GDR had to import almost all raw materials and consumer goods and, for example, fruits and vegetables, which did not grow there, and had to export in order to get Western money to import it. And this was always tight, a tight, tight squeeze, which towards the end, according to most people, the man in charge of the economic affairs was no good. And in addition, the leadership of the GDR in the political Politburo, the leadership of the party, were almost most of them still old-timers who had fought against the Nazis either in Spain or in the underground or had been imprisoned for 10, 12 years sometimes, also in the concentration camps, who were devoted anti-fascists, and that was the whole picture in GDR, was anti-fascism ruled the roost. But they did not properly learn to talk with the population, who they didn't completely trust because so many was always looking towards the West. The rapport between the two was never really accomplished, at least with part. The population varied. Some were very pro, some were very anti, and lots were in the middle, changing depending on the situation. They never did learn properly in the news and in media to talk with people, explain problems, discuss difficulties. They always tried to conceal the difficulties, which led to mistrust on the part of the population. This was the biggest blunder. Also, as relations with the Soviet Union, which were very close in the first years, began to get complicated. For example, the Soviet Union changed its policy of selling petroleum at a very low price, special price to the GDR, and called for the world rate price rate, thinking in part that the standard of living in the GDR was much higher than that in the Soviet Union. Why should we give presents to them? And this became difficult and caused protests, so that the Soviets therefore had a very mixed, sometimes very positive, sometimes complicated in all those years.
So could you comment on like democracy and the GDR? Let's talk about one like free speech and free press. You touched on this a little bit earlier. And then we could also talk about like workplace democracy. So like, did workers have control over their workplaces or their factories, or was there like a bureaucrat that told them what to do?
Well, it's a mixed picture. In the factories, the fact that you couldn't be fired meant for a relatively relaxed atmosphere. The government and the unions and the management had to constantly try to get more production, which wasn't always easy because, it depended on the workforce and their relationship, so that there were certain contradictions. The workers had a voice. In fact, through the unions, they controlled in every factory everything from the kitchen. Everybody got a warm, hot meal at lunchtime, and that's the main meal in Germany. There was somebody in charge of getting good vacations at very cheap, almost nothing, almost free vacations every year. Well, not every year for everybody. There was a certain competition to get the best, but at least every few years, everyone got a 3 weeks at a 30 marks, which is nothing. They were in charge of childcare, in charge of promoting women in the workshops to management positions, in charge of making sure that young people got the proper treatment and certain privileges, in charge of increasing production. In all these things, the union, in charge of kindergarten, which many factories had, the workers had a voice in all these matters, and a voice also in work protection and to a degree in encouraging production, but not in the basic roles of the production quota for the whole factory and for determining things like buying major equipment and so forth. That had to be centrally.
Gotcha.
And this question of how much central and how much in each plant was a complicated question, which varied over the years. They tried various systems, always a difficult problem, which has never been completely solved. There were some interesting experiments in that way, but I can give no final results.
Gotcha.
There was one thing, however, which was interesting on the question of democracy. At the end, when the GDR died, West Germany destroyed almost the entire industry of the country, including everything from universities, the professors, radio, television, journalism, administration. They took over everything and threw most people out. But as people did there was some work going on, of course, it's gradually increased in some areas. And there was a saying among working people who said, during GDR days, it was wise if you didn't criticize Erich Honecker or the other big shots in the Politburo and the party. That was smarter if you didn't. But you could criticize your foreman or your manager all you wanted because you couldn't lose your job. They said, today, under capitalism, it's the other way around. You can criticize the party. If you don't like one party, you can criticize the party leaders and the government all you want, but you better not criticize your foreman or your manager, mm-hmm. because then not only you can't criticize them, you better not, when they call you to do more hours each day or call you on a weekend to come in, you better be thinking before you say no, because you can lose your job easily. And of course, there's always the fear of the plant shutting down. A very different atmosphere and a twist on the question, what is real democracy? There was more real democracy in the plant, in your place of work, but not in the election system or in the media. In the Western system, often, not always, that has permitted to a degree until it's threatened. Mm-hmm. But in the workplace, there's no democracy.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so on social programs, you touched on this earlier. Could you go into more detail about like maternity leave and paternity leave?
Yes.
If women had a baby,
yes.
How much time they got off?
Included in this medical care, which covered everything. It also covered having babies. By the way, it also covered, after 1972, abortion and birth control, free. But if you had a baby, first of all expenses were covered from beginning to end, including, in my case, in one case, the ambulance, in the other case, it was a taxi cab. That was covered. In addition, every baby or every birth was granted, in the early days it was 500, later it was increased to 1,000 marks, which was divided, however, in five installments. The first two installments, if the mother went to have a physical checkup with the doctor to see that she was okay and that the birth was proceeding properly, etc., you know, whether the baby was placed properly. The third and biggest installment, when the baby was born. The fourth and fifth installment, when and if she went to the doctor with her baby for an inspection, with a checkup on both. Plus, for 6 months, a bonus if she nursed the baby. And then, of course, child care was free then. She got 6 months off for maternal leave, six more months without the full pay, but with her job secure, and more with families of three children or more. So that there was no worry in this field of having children. And of course, as I said, the nurseries and the kindergartens were free.
That's awesome. Can you also touch on housing?
Housing was in a catastrophic state at the beginning because so much had been ruined, and of what has not been ruined, so much was very old-fashioned, did not have central heating, often did not have sanitary sometimes didn't even have running water. It varied, but in the cities they had running water, but they often didn't have even proper sanitary conveniences. At the same time, there were lots and lots of people who lost their homes through bombing, and then lots and lots of people came from the Polish areas which had once been German, so that it was jammed. And therefore, in those days, people with apartments with a room to spare often had to share them, whether they liked to or not. We got such. We were put into such sharing. In one case, the people were not friendly and not happy. The other place, it was a widow who was happy to have us. Gradually, especially after the 50s, they started building homes again, first in selected areas. Starting with the 70s, the aim was to have everybody have an affordable home of their own. The rent rates were kept the same from 1945 until the end 1990, with no raises.
Wow.
Which meant that some of the facades in the cities were not well taken care of. But inside, they lived very well. But this left a bad impression for visitors and tourists, especially in East Berlin. But because they couldn't manage that, especially the privately owned ones, they couldn't manage to keep up and at that same rate. But they had to keep to that rate. So that, which amounted in general to about 6 or 8, perhaps 10% of your pay went for rent, no more. And as I think I said, you couldn't be evicted. That was forbidden. Evicting was forbidden. If you didn't pay too long, they might put you out, but not until they found another place for you to live. So that in all those 38 years I lived there, I saw not a single person sleeping in the park or on the street. And no beggars, because everybody had a place to live, including, for example, people who got out of prison. Some people were in prison for various reasons. When they got out, they immediately were given a place to live and a job, if possible, in a work team which could help to integrate them into working life, you know, with time and so forth, so that they were not on the streets either. This was part of the housing system, which meant that it may have taken many people a long time to get a good modern apartment, and many people were angry because it took them so long. But this was gradually being solved towards the end, in the end with almost 2 million new apartments.
That's great. So you still live in Germany. So what could they do, or what will they need to do, to reestablish socialism and make it last this time around? What was done incorrectly the first time?
Some pressure from the East, from the Soviets, but giant, huge pressure from the West. the brain drain, but especially this television hammering all the time and telling people how wonderful it was in the West and how terrible it was where they were living, and with in a very flashy, well done television methods, I would say borrowed in part from Goebbels and in part from Madison Avenue, and the GDR never learned how to counter that in a convincing and engaging way. They had some wonderful television programs, but as soon as it came to political questions in East and West, it was boring, it was unconvincing, it was poor. And this was one of the reasons for the downfall, as well as increasing economic pressures, which were part of a developing new 21st century. Well, it was before then, of course, 10 years before, but they were trying to keep up in, for example, an electronic sphere. The little GDR couldn't manage it alone. And it was also threatened militarily. It had to keep up with that. And this housing, and the fact that the leadership never really learned to discuss these problems with the people in a convincing way. All this led to the downfall, and what the people did not expect, that they would immediately lose all their jobs, that, for example, all GDR books, not only left-wing books, but art books, travel books, classics, American translations, were all, within a very short time, were all destroyed. They were all thrown on the rubbish heap and destroyed. What are the chances again? Well, I don't suppose that I'll live to see it, but at my age, it's the same question which faces the United States. When enough people, first of all, learn, as some people have learned already, but when more people and when a lot of people learn to fight for their rights, and then learn that important as it is to win gains for rights for children, for women, the basic question which faces us in terms of the climate change, in terms of the dangers now growing all the time of fascists in Europe and also in the United States, involving especially racism and militarism and nationalism, plus the terrible danger which many Americans do not see, perhaps even accidental, triggering of a world war which could be atomic if it's between Russia and America, and which would make all questions about climate change, everything would burn up. And people don't see this enough, but to see that to blame on all of these questions basically are this smaller and smaller group of multi-billionaires who soak all the people they work for, who store their billions away in the Cayman Islands or in Liechtenberg or in Switzerland, or in yachts and bigger and bigger buildings in New York and other elsewhere, and who heap it up and heap it higher and higher, and force people into having less and less regular, clear-cut, well-paid, fairly paid jobs, until these forces, these billionaire companies, are, as in my view, have been thrown out. Have been thrown out so that people earn as much as they work for. In other words, no more profits. This is something that the GDR achieved. That's why they were able, in spite of all the shortages, and that they never caught up West Germany and had debts, nevertheless, they had practically abolished poverty. And when this is the only way to achieve this, as I see it, was as in the GDR, to throw all of those millionaires and billionaires out of their jobs and to take over.
So what are your thoughts on the future of the CPUSA in the midst of our 31st convention?
My hope, not for the CPUSA, but for the entire left in the United States, is that they overcome past differences, which are often old and obsolete, that they move together with the new movements which have developed in the last 5, 10, 15 years, the Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. women's movement, the gay movement, but especially most important, the peace movement, which should be really the cementing point of it, that they get together supporting those forces within the Democratic Party who seem to be progressive. I would include Bernie Sanders, although he's not in the Democratic Party. I would include Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other, these young congresspeople who are amazing, supporting them, but not being in illusions about the Democratic Party, whose leadership is still not that different from out of the Republican Party. And therefore, the main pressure should be on organizing people in all these different organizations to fight for their rights and to learn more and more in more and more numbers how to fight for their rights in the streets, in the factories, in the schools, wherever, and merge these fights into a fight against the billionaires who still rule, whether it's Amazon and Facebook or in the pharma industry, or especially the armaments industry, to work in that direction, whether people are in the Democratic Party or not. If they're moving towards the left, to find ways of working together without illusions, but without forgetting a final goal, which is to get rid of those monopolies and oligopolies, or whatever they are, these billionaires who are tearing the world apart.
Thank you to Victor Grossman and Dante for this awesome episode. Victor Grossman's latest book, A Socialist Defector, From Harvard to Karl Marx Alley, is a powerful narrative that lays out for us truths about life on both sides of the Berlin Wall that we've probably never considered. Grossman confronts us too with our own U.S. history, one we all know too little about. Victor also wrote an earlier memoir called Crossing the River, a memoir of the American left, the Cold War, and life in East Germany, available for purchase through the University of Massachusetts. And we have some exciting episodes coming up, so please stay tuned, and thanks for listening.